This is WJBC This Week.
The bill is so corrupt. It is corrupt and it is so corrupt. It would make Rod Blagojevich blush.
Police lives matter. Black lives matter. White lives matter. How about we just simply state lives matter?
To the people who think the museum should close, think of how much fun your kids and family could have there.
It comes down to whether they have to quit their job to stay home with their children.
So try and honor a legacy. This is a significant event for this community.
Welcome to WJBC This Week, where we look back at the top stories and interviews from the past week. I'm Eric Stock. On this week's program, McLean County's sheriff sounds off on another shooting death of a police officer. Steve Fast talked to a Rolling Stones reporter about his interview with author and Illinois State alum David Foster Wallace, which became a movie. Tim Lewis talks to a relationship expert about the Ashley Madison hacking and how to save a marriage. A McLean County native and author offers grilling tips for men. Plus, WJBC's Throwback Thursday interview with the former Illinois State football coach, Jim Haycock. That and more coming up. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. The shooting death of a veteran police officer in the small northern Illinois community of Fox Lake this week was another unsettling moment for relations between police and the public they serve. McLean County Sheriff John Sandage offered his thoughts to WJBC's Terry James this week.
How does it affect you? This was in a town of 60,000. We have about 125 here. How does that affect you?
It just reminds you that you need to be aware of your surroundings. And the part that hurts is that an officer is out there doing his job, protecting his community, and there are people out there that think so little of police officer that they would take their lives.
The thing I can't wrap my head around is they think they're going to be given a gold medal for this or that they're going to get away. I mean, the best they're going to get is life in prison, and the worst is they're probably going to get shot during the manhunt.
Right, and I think a lot of this goes back as far as disrespect for the police and questioning what the police do. It goes back to Ferguson, when the President of the United States and the Attorney General, Eric Holder, came out demonizing that officer before they had all the facts. And that's just wrong.
Do you think in that situation it was a political attempt to get public opinion on their side?
I think it could have been. And, you know, here's the thing. They were quick to go on TV and make statements in regards to this. Yet here in the past month, we've had 10 police officers killed nationwide. I have yet to see a press conference with the President of the United States talking about the 10 police officers that have been killed.
And really, the Black Lives Matter movement, I heard somebody say the other day, well, you know what? Police officers' lives matter, too. It's not just one race.
It's not race. Everybody's life matters. Take the race, take the profession, everything out of it. All lives matter.
And then, I had a cameraman in the other day to talk about what happened in Virginia. Do you think that we need to strengthen somehow our mental health guidelines when it comes to getting a gun? What are your thoughts there?
I think the system that's in place now, it works as well as any system will. You're always going to have things that slip through the cracks. Who knows that a person's first mental episode might be the one that's deadly. You just never know. There's so many variables when it comes to mental health and so many things that can go wrong. Like I said, you're always going to have things that slip through the cracks.
Well, and the community's behind you here, and I definitely know that from folks I've talked to. But around the nation, it's becoming a scary place. And like I said, I just don't get it because these people are not going to be held as heroes that are shooting police just to shoot them.
No. And especially to – they're not just shooting officers. The case in Houston, that was an assassination. That was about as cowardly as you can get.
Absolutely. And, you know, and why are they cowards? They're cowards because, well, they want to make the shooting and then get away.
Right.
I'm not saying to do it by any means, but I'm saying the way they're acting, hold a march, write a letter,
right.
Hold up a sign on a corner. We have the right to do that in this country. You can't do that in every country.
Right. And there's even some groups that are protesting now encouraging the killing of officers. And I'm sorry, I think you're getting to the point. Why is this not considered domestic terrorism?
I agree. If you promote the killing of a police officer, I don't know the law like you do, but wouldn't that be somewhat conspiracy if it happens?
Well, I think they need to take a serious look at these laws. And if you're truly going to protect your police officers who are out there every day protecting your community, there needs to be better laws written and stiffer punishments when an officer is assaulted or killed.
Yeah, we need to start having marches for the lives of police officers, because like that officer in Houston, his two kids and wife, they didn't deserve to right. not have a father anymore.
Yeah. And don't get me wrong, there is bad in every profession. It's inevitable. So there are the cases that give law enforcement a black eye. But by and large, you have very dedicated officers out there who put their lives on the line every day just so you can enjoy where you live.
That was McLean County Sheriff John Sandage with Terry James. The recently released film, The End of the Tour, is a biopic portrayal of author David Foster Wallace, the Illinois State professor and acclaimed author behind Infinite Jest, who took his own life in 2008. The movie, starring Jason Segel, is based on a book written by Rolling Stones reporter David Lipsky, who visited Bloomington Normal in 1996 to profile this rising literary phenom, though nothing from his visit was ever published until after David Foster Wallace's death. Lipsky talked with WJBC's Steve Fast this week.
Let's talk a little bit about your visit to Bloomington Normal.
When I first got off the airplane in March of 1996, I went to his advanced prose class at ISU, and the students were excited, and they knew something cool was happening to their professor, but they loved him anyway. Right? They'd already loved him before because he's a great professor, and he is a thrillingly electric person to have in the room with you.
Even before Infinite Jest, there are probably other more prestigious appointments Dave could have gotten or places he could have went. And I wonder if, in your estimation, when you came here and you saw the way he interacted and the way that he felt about his place within not only a group of young up-and-coming writers, but in that idea of becoming some sort of pseudo-celebrity, if you felt that this was a place where he was trying to keep himself at a distance from that.
He said a kind of cool thing about that. He said that whenever he goes to New York, and it's a great line in the movie, and Jason Segel says it in a really great way, he said that whenever he goes to New York, what he mostly hears are egos in various stages of inflation and deflation. And then he said a great thing about reading reviews of Infinite Jest. A lot of them were really strong. Some of them were less strong, and some of them were angry about the fact that this great new young writer had come along, and that, you know, that will happen with many critics are often people who are writing books themselves. And so they have that response of seeing a chair going to someone else too. And so he said when he read those reviews and he watched himself becoming upset, he said, that's one of the reasons why I love to live and teach in Bloomington. Because when you're in New York, you feel, how could they do this to me? How could they talk that way about me? And then he's saying, me, 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 me. And then he said that when in Bloomington, it's like, huh, what an interesting storm going on outside. Glad I'm inside. He's from Illinois. He grew up in Illinois. And I wondered, as you were asking that question, if there was a strength in being where he was from in a way that he got to be living inside himself, kind of inside the geographical version of himself while he was writing this great stuff. So I wonder if that was kind of a strength. But I kind of wonder if that may have been one of the reasons why he could do such great work back in Illinois, because in a way he was recreating an atmosphere that worked for him, that had always been successful for him.
I think for sure he definitely tailored the atmosphere to be something that he could deal with. I mean, he rather prominently didn't have a television. He found a place where he could be on the edge of town, and it wasn't all that far, as you say, from where he grew up. You could step out of his house on the edge of Bloomington, and it probably wouldn't look all that different than stepping out of his house where he grew up in Philo while his parents were teaching at the University of Illinois and other places.
I think that was part of what Dave said was really working for him coming back to Bloomington, is that he said, you know, we had a very nice time together, and he said, look, when you take off tomorrow, I'm going to go back to just knowing 20 people total. And he knew that was good for the kind of work that he really wanted to do.
Do you remember a lot about that class that you sat in on? What was it like?
It was great. I remember a lot. And I took, he didn't want me tape recording, so I took very careful notes. And when you take notes on things, something I think about the actual muscle of having to recreate the world in ink while it's going on makes you remember more clearly. Because I was taking notes because I wasn't able to tape, David had said, don't tape. That was his other request. You know, I don't want you taping my students. I have clear visual memory as well as, of course, the notes of what he was saying to them. He gave them great advice. He said that one of the key things about being a writer and doing any kind of creative work is being able to understand how an alien consciousness might respond to what it is that you're writing. Because what is interesting for me may not be interesting for you as a reader. He said to the class, like, I may be fascinated about getting in my car and going to the store, but that may not be as interesting to you to read. And then he said, they do a really good version of the class in the movie. One of the students said, you know, I just would like to have my narrator be funny and smart. And he said, well, here's the thing. Just if you want to have a funny, smart narrator, have them say funny, smart things some of the time. He had the ability, and I think it's one of the real strengths of his prose, both fiction and nonfiction, is to be brilliant while also being informal. So that sometimes when people speak to us in a brilliant way, we somehow feel that their brain or their words are kind of wearing a jacket and tie. And that wasn't a problem that he had. I mean, he was, you know, he made a mistake. He said something he didn't like, and he said to the class, brain fart. And I remembered something a couple of years after I'd been with him, I went and spent a bunch of time at West Point at the U.S. Military Academy watching cadets be trained to be officers. And the most popular professor there, who also was a great military leader, and he was teaching them and how to do the military tasks that are the broadest part of their job. And he talked about instruction, about teaching, and he said it's not just about taking care of them or training them. What it's also about is presenting a charismatic model that your students can aspire to. And that was one of the things that really struck me when I was talking to that colonel about what he thought teaching was. I remember very clearly how effective and brilliant and charismatic and kind of what a model of attention he was presenting to the students of advanced prose at ISU in the spring of 1996.
So do you think he was trying to present any kind of charismatic model to you when you were interviewing him?
No, he couldn't help do that because his writing, a part of what was great about it for me was always the disjunction between what you would like to experience and what you actually are experiencing. His approach as someone who's traveling with someone who he knows is going to write about him, was to actually be completely open and honest, right? To say, here's what I feel. This is scary to me. He's saying, but look, the thing I'm anxious about is this will raise my expectations for myself. And expectations for us can be great. They can be a flamethrower held to our ass, but beyond a certain point, they're paralyzing and toxic. He was trying to take the charisma away. But one of the things that we love in writing, one of the things we love in all art, is someone saying, here's how it actually feels. And so he was a charismatic model of brilliant and brilliantly expressed honesty. And he was giving the best presentation, I thought, of how to feel as a writer when you start getting the attention that you've worked all your career to try to get.
That was Rolling Stones author David Lipsky with Steve Fast. You can catch the entire interview at WJBC.com. The recent release of data that hackers obtained from the Ashley Madison website has brought the issue of marriage infidelity back to the forefront. WJBC's Tim Lewis talked to relationship expert Laura Doyle, author of the book First Kill All the Marriage Counselors, and about what to do if you have an unfaithful partner.
How come today it's so, well, if we don't get along, we'll just get divorced?
I think it does have a lot to do with women feeling more empowered about having financial options, right? We have other choices besides just staying married to our husbands in terms of supporting ourselves. So that's certainly a piece of it. I mean, in a way, I think it's a good thing that we removed some of the shame about divorce, because if you think about a woman who's getting beat up by her husband, or she's married to an alcoholic, like you're saying,
mm-hmm.
it doesn't need to be a life sentence. I don't think we want anyone to necessarily stay in that situation and feel like they can't because they'd be thrown out of church or their community. So from that standpoint, you know, it's okay. It's a little bit looser. But it is tragic, however. Like, I know for me, I'm also from a broken home. My parents are divorced. And so I got that modeling. That was what I saw happening.
Right.
And I was following a failed recipe, and I very nearly got the same result. I almost divorced my husband in years, you know, like 5, 6, and 7. Things were going really bad. And I just thought I'd married the wrong guy, and I just needed to get out, and that was that. And I didn't see any alternatives. And I think most people don't know that when you go to marriage counseling, there was a study at UCLA where they found that couples who had received traditional behavioral marriage counseling, 75% of them were separated within a year. So that's not necessarily helping the situation either. So I make a little distinction. I'm a relationship coach, not a marriage counselor.
Mm-hmm.
And I think marriage counseling is actually part of the problem. I think the rise of marriage counseling is part of what has us divorcing so frequently.
And I think because this is my opinion, I think you probably echo the same thing, is when you're in there with your spouse who you're having problems with, it's you're bringing up all these troubles, and it stays on the surface, and you kind of stay mad.
Exactly, Tim. I think no couple ever got happier by complaining about each other for an hour a week.
Right.
It just doesn't work that way. I mean, the other thing is, I'll confess to you that when I dragged my husband to marriage counseling, I had just one objective in mind, and that was that she was going to fix him so that I could finally be happy. And, of course, that's not how it works, but I think plenty of us go into it with that mindset. I think another problem, we had a therapist recently reach out to us. We do have marriage counselors, actually, reach out to us quite a bit for to save their marriage, and they say, well, it's just I can't see it because it's my marriage, and that's why I'm not. I can help other people, but I just can't seem to fix my own marriage. Well, no, that's not how it works. You know, if you want a personal trainer, you want somebody who's fit. You don't want the one with the big belly, right, who's about to have bypass surgery or something.
Right.
You know, if you have a financial advisor, you don't want the one that's on the verge of bankruptcy. You want the one who's, you know. Anyway, point is, with marriage, it's the same thing. You got to find somebody who actually has what you want, and that pretty diploma on the wall is no guarantee of that. So, you know, for me, it was just a big revelation when I asked women who had been married for 15 years or more what their secrets were, and they were completely the opposite of everything that I'd learned growing up, and opposite of everything I read in Glamour magazine, if you can imagine that. And they were the opposite of what I learned in marriage counseling, too.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's get a quick synopsis or a glimpse into how you operate as a counselor. And, you know, I've been talking a little bit this morning about the Ashley Madison situation, and
right.
Which is a website that was only made for cheaters.
its whole
purpose was married people who wanted to cheat. And with the recent hacking of it and the exposure of everybody that was on it, I'm sure there's a lot of people that discovered, ooh, my spouse is on there. And men cheat, women cheat in relationships, and how can a relationship honestly survive a spouse who has cheated?
Well, it really can and we'll make a big distinction here. So here's what you can do to keep your spouse from cheating, but there's a caveat, and that is if they're just not a chronic cheater. So there are these men who just don't seem to be capable of being faithful. And mm-hmm. if you've got one of those, then you know what? You're never going to have a great, intimate, passionate, peaceful relationship like you're wanting. And I call it a divorce I endorse, because it really isn't a marriage at that point. The whole concept of marriage is monogamy, until death do us part. So if you've got one of those guys, then it really, gosh, you've got my permission to get out. But if you have a good guy, so he's not always cheating, then a lot of times the affair is an inappropriate reaction, but it's a reaction to years of not getting the most important thing that men need in a marriage, and that is not sex. People think it's sex. No, it's respect. Respect is like oxygen for men. And where we get into trouble in marriages here is that a lot of women don't realize they're being disrespectful. They have no concept of it. They just don't see it the same way that men do. So
what do they do that's disrespectful?
Well, you know, I used to roll my eyes at things my husband was saying, or I'd interrupt him. Another really terrible habit I had was when we were first married, I thought, well, I'm going to help improve him. You know, I'm going to tell him how to dress better and how to eat healthier and how to, I'm going to show him how to redo his resume. And you're laughing, but, you know, a lot of women, we don't realize, we think we're just being helpful. And unfortunately, helpful in wife language equals critical in husband language. And you're just poking holes in the bucket of your intimacy, and that's why he eventually becomes very susceptible to anybody. A woman at work could say, wow, you did a great job on that project, or, you know, will you take a look at my project? And it's like irresistible for him because he needs that respect so much.
That was a relationship expert and author Laura Doyle with Tim Lewis. Today's local news is next. This is WGBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. This Labor Day weekend could be one of the last times many of us can break out the grill this summer. For John Scholl, a McLean County native, grilling is more than just a hobby. It's a lifestyle, and one the Danvers man has turned into a second career of sorts. He's created a group called ManBQ and has compiled the recipe book by that name. Scholl offers his grilling tips to WJBC's Scott Laughlin and Colleen Reynolds this week.
Is there the ultimate barbecue grill? You know, some people are a big fan of
the
green egg. Others say, oh, no, the good old-fashioned Weber is the best way to go. Gas is cleaner and better, and you can do a lot more.
Then you've got the ultra, what do you call it? Oh, never mind. I'll never remember.
I mean, do you have a favorite?
Well, for me personally, I'm a fan of the Weber kettle, just a traditional charcoal. But I have a gas one, too. So I have two children. When I come home from work, 6 o'clock on a weekday, I want to cook something and be done with it. So the gas grill is great for that. And I guess it's really what you're looking for. So if you're looking to do tailgates, a big green egg might not necessarily be the best option for you because they're 300 pounds, and who wants to tote that around? You know, so really, we do have a diagram that says, you know, what are you looking for? Are you looking to do just mainly smoking? You know, get this type of grill. Are you looking to do a smoking and grilling? You know, we recommend some other types of grills. Or if you're just looking to do grilling alone, we have recommendations for that. So it really is kind of what your goal is with outdoor cooking.
One of our regulars on the show is big into smoking. He's got several smokers, loves smoking. Maybe he'd be interested in starting a Central Illinois chapter. Is that possible?
Oh, I would love to have a Central Illinois chapter. I've had some friends approach me about it. In fact, when I was down for Danvers Days, we were talking about getting one going. And it would be the smoker friend that you have or one of my friends would need to come up or visit another chapter just to kind of see how it works, how the events work. And then we kind of give them free range to do what they want and set up their events. But, yeah, if anybody's interested, just feel free to look us up on the website and reach out to us.
So the street food, how did that book evolve? Where did that come from?
Well, being in the city and traveling, we have three authors on the book. We just kind of, whenever we hit a new city, you know, you really find the feel of the culture through the food. And the quickest way to do that is to find a street stand on a corner somewhere and try it. So we just started experimenting. We wanted to get away from grilling a little bit because I think the first book is all grilling and, you know, it's kind of hard to top what we have in there. So we decided to take on deep frying and oven cooking, you know, just different techniques, which broaden our horizons and, again, trying to broaden our market as well.
So what do you do in real life? Is this your career?
I wish. My career, I actually work in media in Chicago in advertising.
In real life, what do you do?
Mm-hmm.
In real life,
yeah.
Marketing.
Wow. So
but there will be a book tour and stuff with a new book, and we hope to get down there to have a release party sometime next spring.
Next spring, and then we'll be grilling up in the parking lot of the Barnes & Noble?
Yeah, hopefully. I know I have a friend down there who roasts hogs, so Biddy's Barbecue. So hopefully I can get him out for the event, and he can show off what he has to do down there and provide some good barbecue.
All right. The name of the book is Man BQ, and you have Man BQ clubs. Are women allowed in Man BQ clubs?
Yes, we do not discriminate.
All right, Colleen.
So I have to ask you about a barbecue tip that was once given on this radio station by a chef and by a barbecue chef. Let me ask you, have you ever done this? He said, to make your meat more tender on the grill, you should put an ice cube on the top of it. Have you ever heard that tip? Does that make any sense?
I've not heard that. I've heard about putting your bacon in the freezer right before you cook it to make it crispier, but I have not heard the ice cube trick.
Really? Bacon in the freezer before you? Have you tried it?
I have, and it works.
It works. All right, here's another. Let's see here. Your meat, if you take your meat out of the refrigerator, let it sit for about 20 minutes to get to room temperature.
Absolutely. I cooked hamburgers last weekend, and even the ground beef patties.
I never do that.
Out of the refrigerator.
I need to start doing that.
John, what's your favorite thing to cook on the grill?
Chicken wings, by far, because you could do so much with them.
Seems like it would be hard to do chicken wings.
To measure the temperature, because you need to do it away from the bone, and we know chicken wings, it's a lot of bone.
Yeah, but I mean, if you set up, say, your charcoal grill, you set it up for indirect heat, so you have a hot zone and a cool zone. You can time them out about 3 minutes, quarter turn, three more minutes, so probably around 12 minutes, and they're done. And the fun thing with chicken wings is you can use so many different sauces. So you create a marinade or brine them, throw them on the grill, and then you can have two different sauces and have essentially two different dishes by the time you're done with hardly much more work.
That was John Scholl of Man BQ with Scott and Colleen. One of the longest-serving coaches in the last 50 years for Illinois State football was Jim Haycock, who spent 8 seasons at ISU in the late 1980s to mid-90s. At one point, he hired future Ohio State coach Urban Meyer before he would join Ohio State staff himself. He ended up coaching there for 17 years before retiring in 2012. Jim Haycock talked with WJBC's Brian Bloodworth in our Throwback Thursday interview this week.
You spent 8 years at Illinois State as a head coach, and, you know, I always felt like you were the one that kind of changed the culture of the program and brought in more discipline and structure, which ultimately, I think, laid the foundation for the success that Brock is having with his teams now, albeit it was maybe 16, 17, 18 years ago, but tell us about your time at ISU, and was that kind of the thing that you had to do?
Well, first of all, I appreciate that. That's awfully nice of you to say that, and I can assure you that Sherry and I both have great fond memories of ISU and our time there, and our girls going through elementary school at North Point, and the football part of it was just an unbelievable experience. Great. I guess the thing that we always talk about is the type of people that we dealt with at Illinois State, and I think when we went in there, we had to clean some stuff up, and discipline was a big factor, and we had kind of made a plan to keep things academics important and keep things going in the right direction, and I've always thought Illinois State's a great school and should have good football and should have good basketball, should have good everything, academics. I just think it's a great location. And like I've said over and over, the people there are just, as good as anywhere we've ever been. And it was a great experience for us. But it was a challenge. I guess you always regret you don't win every single game. But if we had to do... if there was one regret, it would be that we didn't win as many games as we'd have liked to, but always felt like we put the time in and the effort and tried to, make some inroads and do things the right way and try and improve the situation. And hopefully we did. You know, as you look back on it, you know, I think we were able to improve the culture and the philosophy and basically the way the program was looked at. So it was a definitely, you know, Sherry and I both look at it as a very positive experience in our lives and in our girls.
I know if one word would describe you, in my mind, it would be driven. I mean, I know you'd be at the office at 5 in the morning and maybe stay till midnight on more than one occasion, but that was just kind of your style. I mean, are you still pretty high strung, or did you kind of finally figure out over the years, maybe I can relax a little bit?
That was pretty much just the way I was. I guess I was all in the coaching profession, and I tried to, you know, at least, you know, split time, you know, make family as important or you know, obviously more important. But, you know, I that's just the way I was. And when I came here to Ohio State, I was here for 16 years and did the same thing. I tried to get in early and tried to work hard and make sure that nobody was, you know, working harder. But I think that's just me. And I guess when it came down to it, I had thought about staying in coaching for a while. And really the reason I got out is I did spend so much time at the office that I really looked forward to spending time with my family. And, you know, after 41 years of craziness of, you know, unbelievable hours and intensity and, you know, all those things, it's really been, you know, rewarding for me to have this time now when I can actually sit down with my daughters and spend time with them and do things with them and travel with my wife. I guess the intensity which I attacked coaching is one of the reasons I really have now enjoyed the retirement, and you know, I can spend time on things that I feel like I neglected a little bit.
But obviously that hard work paid off, and in 2007 you were awarded the Top Assistant Coach of the Year award, and that had to be very gratifying.
There's highlights, you know, there's good and bad in coaching. It's not all good and it's not all bad, but that was certainly a highlight for me, and it was really an honor. And you know me from being at Illinois State, I appreciate the award, but I'm pretty aware of the fact that it takes a lot of different people to pull something off like that. And I know I had some good assistants I was working with, and we had good players. There's no doubt about that. And you know, it's humbling, and it's, you know, like I say, I'm very appreciative of the honor. But you know, I hope I made a lot of people aware of the other people that put a lot of time in to make that possible. But it was a great honor.
You mentioned assistant coaches. You had a lot of assistant coaches that came through Illinois State with you that went on to be very successful. Obviously, there's Urban Meyer, Paul Christ at Wisconsin, and I know just off the top, I know Charlie Molnar went on and became a successful coach at Notre Dame assistant, and I know I'm missing some, but those guys you really helped develop.
Yeah, you know, I mean, we were fortunate. You know, we tried to bring in good people. You know, that's, I guess any head coach is going to try and do that. We really, you know, I really tried to bring in good quality people and guys that I thought could, you know, be good coaches. And like you said, so many of them turned out that way. And of course, Urban's, you know, down here now, and I work part time for him. My second year out here, I went back and worked part time for him, and he was really, you know, a guy that helped me get the job here at Ohio State when I left Illinois State. So, and Paul Christ, you know, has done such a great job at, you know, Pittsburgh, now up at Wisconsin, and he'll be a outstanding coach. Think about all those guys; they're just, you know, good people, and they were good for family people, and they were fun to have on the staff. And I guess it's rewarding for me just to see them go on and have the success they're having. And like you said, there's a lot more than those two. I mean, there are several of them went back into the high school ranks and have been very successful. But it's, you know, there's some guys now that are doing pretty good.
Memorable games for you, not necessarily at Illinois State only, but Ohio State, or things that, you know, in your coaching career that really stand out, or lessons that you learned or picked up?
Well, I think, you know, the one that comes to mind for me is beating Southern Illinois. I think it was probably my second year there. I think we went to, it was a league game. I think the first league game Illinois State had won for a couple of years, and I just remember that victory. And, you know, we had put a lot of time and effort into it, and to get a win down at Southern Illinois was, I always remember that game. I'm from the Midwest, so the Rose Bowl's always been a big, you know, I just have always liked watching the Rose Bowl, and, you know, I've been a Rose Bowl guy, so we were able to win that twice in my time here at Ohio State. Those two, just the 2010 year was just, you know, that experience at the Rose Bowl is just, for me, was as good as it gets, and then to win those two games was great. And, you know, in 2002, we won the national championship and went 14-0, and I guess in coaching, what you want to do is win every game, and that was the only year of my coaching career that we won every game. So, you know, that all those games that year, it was each game was unique and each game was difficult, and no one gave us any chance of winning the national championship. But we had a good group of senior leaders and a good group of kids that just made up their minds that kind of they were going to, you know, get it done, and it was fun to be a part of that and see them perform. And I don't know how many games we won right at the end of the game, and, you know, it was really not pretty at times, but to see those guys come out at the end and win the national championship and beat Miami, was that game was, it was, you know, obviously when you win the national championship was spectacular. So, but, you know, almost every place I've been, you know, I was at the University of Washington. We had some great games out there, and a lot of memories at Illinois State, and certainly memories I'll never forget.
That was our Throwback Thursday interview with the former Illinois State football coach, Jim Haycock. The Weekend News is next. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. Time now for the Weekend News. Illinois State University is once again paying tribute to the seven people who were killed in a plane crash in April. There will be a moment of silence before the football home opener next weekend with the victims' families on hand. Athletics Director Larry Lyons tells WJBC's Scott Lachlan the families will also take part in a private dedication of a permanent memorial that is being built outside Redbird Arena.
To give the family the families a place to come that's hopefully comforting, hopefully peaceful, accessible to them. So to try and honor a legacy, this is a significant event for this community.
Redbird student-athletes are all wearing patches that will include the initials of the seven people who were killed. Lyons notes the football home opener on September 12th happens to fall on Aaron Leach's birthday. He was one of the seven who died. And ISU not only breaking fundraising records, they're also reporting a record-breaking freshman class. More than 3,600 freshmen are starting their first year at Illinois State. That's the largest freshman class in 26 years. Total enrollment up by 1% over the last semester to nearly 20,800. U.S. Cellular Coliseum saw a loss of more than $250,000 in the first quarter of the budget year. That's less than the budgeted operating loss of $315,000. General Manager Bart Rogers says the first quarter was always the most difficult time for the Coliseum because of the competition in the area. The venue also reports an economic impact of $4.2 million in the first part of the fiscal year. Connect Transit's aging fleet of buses is getting some new sets of wheels. The company unveiled five new buses Friday. General Manager Andrew Johnson says those are the first round of what will be up to 30 in the next 5 years.
We cannot wait until these buses are out on the street serving the citizens of Bloomington Normal. And I'll tell you, with a 47% increase in Connect Transit ridership, these could not have come at a better time.
The buses were paid for primarily with money from the Federal Highway Trust Fund. Senator Dick Durbin, who is on hand for the event, says Congress needs to pass a long-term transportation bill so projects like this can continue to be funded. Jason Hopkins, the man who allegedly attacked three people in downtown Bloomington last month, has been ruled unfit to stand trial. McLean County Judge Scott Drzeski issued the ruling this week. Hopkins was charged with two counts of attempted murder and one count of aggravated assault for allegedly stabbing two people and beating another. Hopkins spit on Drzeski during his arraignment last week, and the judge ordered a mental health examination at that time. Hopkins will be placed in an inpatient treatment facility while he awaits trial. Illinois won't be held in contempt for failing to pay for services for the developmentally disabled on time. Bill Cieslowski, attorney for the Miser Cordia home in Chicago, says he still believes the state comptroller's office is lying about the state not having enough money to pay providers and other obligations.
2 weeks ago, the state had ample funds to make the payments they've now made in the last 2 weeks. So the question as to why, is it just bureaucracy at its worst, the right hand not knowing what the left hand's doing? Maybe. Is it something more sinister? Who knows?
Cieslowski is leaving the door open on trying to hold the state in contempt if more payments arrive late. And a lack of funding from the state because of the budget impasse has led Heartland Head Start to reduce its staff. That means fewer classes, and according to Director Karen Bruning, it leaves parents with a tough choice to make.
It comes down to whether they have to quit their job to stay home with their children. You know, unless they can find somebody that can care for their child, but some of them are not making enough money to be able to pay for that.
Bruning says another pressure point on Head Start is the fact Governor Rauner issued a ruling to change the eligibility requirements for child care assistance, so many of their usual families are not eligible for the program this year. And Mitsubishi Motors hasn't seen a slowdown in sales since announcing it'll halt production at its plant in Normal this fall. August marked the 18th straight month of year-over-year sales increases after the company saw a jump of 22% versus August of last year. Year-to-date sales are now up about 24%. The 2016 Outlander had its best sales month in 12 years, and sales up close to 93% compared to August of last year. Up next, the week to come. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. It's time to take a look ahead at the week to come. Monday is Labor Day, and the Bloomington and Normal Trades and Labor Assembly is sponsoring its annual Labor Day Parade, starting at 10 a.m. from downtown Bloomington to Miller Park. On Tuesday, Normal's Town Council will vote on a proposed 1% sales tax increase. On Thursday, the 18th Congressional District special election will be decided as Republican Darren Hood faces Democrat Rob Mellon for Aaron Schock's former congressional seat. And next Saturday, Illinois State and Illinois Wesleyan play their football home openers. The Redbirds take on Morgan State. The Titans entertain Alma College. This has been WJBC This Week. To listen to this week's program again, go to the WJBC.com podcast page. I'm Eric Stock.